Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A decorated Army veteran who served in Afghanistan found he was dealing with PTSD issues working as a Border Patrol agent near Laredo, Texas. The job, the same desert appearance, and listening for foreign languages tripped something. He asked for a transfer to the Canadian border, and the Department of Homeland Security is fighting him in court. We'll have that later, but first, farmers in this state often complain they can't get Michigan workers to harvest cherries, apples, or other crops, so they need migrant workers. These are families, often Mexican families, who travel from farm to farm hand-harvesting foods such as asparagus. And it's exactly that situation we're going to discuss. Tom Thornburg is co-managing attorney with Farm Worker Legal Services in Kalamazoo. Let's set some groundwork here. The current federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. The state minimum wage was raised to $8.50 an hour. Some farmers don't have to pay the federal minimum wage. Why?
Well, the federal minimum wage, which of course goes all the way back to the New Deal, agricultural employers of a certain size were exempted, as well as any employer who hired fewer than a predetermined amount of labor. It's fairly complicated, Lester, in terms of how that's computed. It has to do with whether or not the employer has 500 man days of labor in a given calendar quarter.
Got it. So that's the federal minimum wage. With the higher state minimum wage at $8.50, do farmers have to pay that?
Every employer in the state of Michigan has to pay the state minimum wage. The reason that there ever was, in the first place, a state minimum wage in 1964 was to ensure that these employers who would not be large enough to fall under the federal minimum wage, there would be at least some floor below which no employer could pay a worker for an hour's work. So the state minimum wage has always been a safety net for employees of employers that are not large enough to be covered by the federal minimum wage.
A family you're representing say they get paid far less than that, and they complain to the Michigan's wage and hour program. What happened in this case?
Well, that's the crux of our dispute right now, is that, as we normally do, we will do outreach to farm workers, or they will call us. They will tell us that they feel they were not paid properly. In this case, a family of six was harvesting asparagus and was paid, we calculated, less than $4 an hour. They filed their complaint with the state wage and hour, as is a very routine practice. And we were totally surprised in February when we got a decision from Wage and Hour saying that they had no jurisdiction to enforce the state minimum wage with respect to this family of agricultural employees.
So how did they determine how to pay them? I mean, did the farmer just arbitrarily say, yeah, I'm not going to pay you $8.50, I'm going to pay you $4?
No, the farmer didn't figure out any hourly wage. He just paid them on by what's a very common way to be paid in agricultural harvesting, which is called the piece rate. That is, he assigned an amount for every pound of asparagus that the family was attributed.
As I understand it, this practice, in the past anyway, has been to pay the per-piece rate or the minimum wage, whichever is higher. Why has that changed?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. That's been not just a practice. That's been the policy of the state of Michigan since 1997, when for the first time the state hourly minimum wage was increased to $4.75 per hour. At that time, the state determined and established in their policy that agricultural employers may contract on a piece rate basis, but they have to pay at least the hourly minimum wage. At that time, it was $4.75. Since that time, it's been increased to $5.15, to $6.95, to $7.15, to $7.40, to $8.15, and now to $8.50. And in every one of those incremental increases, the state has continued to apply its longstanding policy to protect these harvesters at least at the minimum hourly wage. But suddenly, according to this decision, the state has a new interpretation, and that is hand harvesters no longer within the protection of the state minimum wage, and therefore the state won't enforce the current $8.50 an hour as a minimum threshold.
What has changed? What prompted this change?
Intensive lobbying, I think, by some in the agricultural community. I don't think all. I think a lot of employers in the agricultural community understand that it's in their interest to treat workers fairly in all respects, including paying them a fair wage. But I think others argued the policy should change, and it evidently did change, according to the decision that we received in February. And what we're very concerned about is that evidently the policy evidently has changed without there being a consistent change to the stated rules and regulations.
So no notice.
The department.
No notice, no stated change. What happens to this case now, and what in your view can or should be done about this?
Well, certainly we're advising our clients about any legal recourse that they may have to challenge this arbitrary and capricious imposition of a new policy without required notice and public comment. But short of that, I think it's very dangerous for agricultural employers to somehow rely on this arbitrary new stance of wage and hour program and think that they do not need to pay harvesters an hourly minimum wage as a floor, because legally, we think that it's a very strong case that they still do need to do that despite what the state of Michigan has determined, and that if they were to not pay a piece rate harvester at least the hourly minimum wage of $8.50, they would open themselves to potential liability.
Tom Thornburg is co-managing an attorney with Farm Worker Legal Services. Thanks very much for explaining this case to us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for your time.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We wanted to check with the state of Michigan about this decision and whether this is now policy. Jennifer Fields is the wage and hour program manager with the Michigan Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, and she joins us now. Has state policy changed? Are all migrant workers now exempt from the state minimum wage?
The Michigan's Minimum Wage Act, which is a new act, is called Act 138, the Workforce Opportunity Wage Act, took effect in May 27, 2014. Prior to that, it was Act 154. In those rules that went along with 154, there was a piece rate schedule that allowed hand harvesters to be paid on a piece rate basis. The new act does not have the rules promulgated yet, so the new rules are not there for Act 138. So the act itself in Section 10 does say that this act does not apply to agricultural fruit growers, pickle growers, or tomato growers, or other agricultural employers who traditionally contract on a harvesting on a piecework basis, or to those employees used for harvesting until the board has acquired sufficient data to determine an adequate basis to establish a scale of piecework and determines a scale equivalent to the prevailing minimum wage for that employment.
This is quite a break from past practices. Why is it happening?
Because of Act 138 does not have any rules at this time.
And you've had 2 years to promulgate the rules?
Right now, LARA is evaluating the issue to make sure that we're being fair, effective, and efficient in the administration of the laws.
So if, as this family alleges, they're only earning about $4 an hour because of this per piece rate, when the assumption was they'd make at least minimum wage on their part, how is this fair to the workers?
At this point, I can't talk specifically about this case because there is a confidentiality clause in Act 138, which does not allow me to speak specifically about a case, but I can speak generally.
That's what we'd like about, then, yeah.
Yeah, generally, we have to enforce the law as it is written.
Do the migrant workers in the state know this is the case, and have they known for the last 2 years? Why is this the first case 2 years after the fact to come to the state on appeal?
Right. The majority of people that come up here or are in Michigan to pick, they come up here and they have a written wage agreement that outlines what their rate of pay is going to be. And most folks are not going to come here unless they're getting well above minimum wage. So this is a very rare In the last couple years, we've had less than 10 minimum wage claims filed by agricultural piece rate workers. The majority of those, we got those resolved informally.
So when is this going to be cleared up? When are we going to get rules that clearly state that the minimum wage covers migrant workers or not?
Right now, I don't have a date for you. I will just tell you again that Laura is working on evaluating the issue to make sure we're being fair, effective, and efficient.
Not even a ballpark? I mean, is it going to be months? Is it going to be years?
I don't have a ballpark, but as soon as we have more information, we will be providing that to folks.
And is this something the legislature has to approve and then the governor sign off on?
I don't know.
Okay. Jennifer Fields is the Wage and Hour Program Manager with the Michigan Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, new music from the Ann Arbor-based Indian fusion band, Somkali. Plus, we'll hear how a 14-year-old started her own cake business. That's in 15 minutes. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Tomorrow is National Record Store Day. There's a sound you might not have heard for a while. You might have to look hard to find a record store, too, but there's a resurgence of popularity of vinyl, which has led to an increase in the sale of record players. Someone who's been dusting off some old LPs for a while now is Reverend Charles Preston Smith. He's the curator, archivist, vinyl savior. How do you describe yourself at Dodds Records in Grand Rapids?
I think curator of this Dodds Record Shop and Museum is a good way to look at it, and thank you for having me on.
Oh, sure. Glad to have you. You know, you got involved in Dodds a couple of years ago. How did that happen?
Well, it started with Record Store Day. I wanted to play Record Store Day in my whole life. I wanted to put out a record, and I thought, well, until my band gets that together, I'm just going to go set up on the front stoop at Dodds Record Shop and play some music.
Now, this was a surprise appearance, as I understand it.
Yes. I snuck in an extension cord and set up a PA and four bands, and we played all day long. And it was successful, and I did it the next year and the next year. And finally, Mr. Dodds asked me why I'm doing this, and I told him it's Record Store Day. And he smiled and said, it's Record Store Day here every day.
You know, it's harder and harder to even find a good compact disc store, let alone a store that still sells vinyl or cassette tapes. Yet there are certain people who really are driven to find them. So who's interested in the LPs? What age? What kind of, are they musicians? Who's visiting your store and museum?
Now it seems it's younger and younger wanting to experience the new stuff. They're just getting turned on to the classics. So there are quite a few record stores across Michigan and the nation, I guess, that sell the new released vinyl. So what I'm giving is the experience of the classic stuff. Everything that I have, the newest thing is probably 20 years old, unless it was from my personal collection. And that then includes a lot of things that will never be for sale in my store. But I'm getting a wide variety of people, parents, folks my age that bring in their kids and want them to experience what they experienced, and that also includes the snap, crackle, and pop of the records. So we're getting a wide variety of age, but I think it's being driven from the younger crowd.
Now, I want to understand what's happening there. So part of the vinyl you see in the store, look, don't touch, can't buy, and part of it is available. You can browse through it, and you can purchase it. That's right?
Sure. I'd rather you trade me something for the item I don't want to sell than I don't feel bad about exchanging a few bucks for it when it's just too cool to let go. But you bring me in something that's just as cool, and you can take this home.
Now, do you have anything special planned for National Record Store Day?
Well, because we just relocated the store, it's been downtown Grand Rapids for about 65 years, and I've been at this for 3.5. We just 2 months ago pushed it just outside of downtown to the west side, and so this grand reopening, we plan a parade up and down the street, and we've got a dozen bands and people lined up for the parade and a lot of festivities that the community right here in Grand Rapids West Side is going to be a part of.
What was the reason for the move?
The area downtown is growing so much that the record store wouldn't be able to sustain itself unless I went, you know, head first into full time, and this museum to sustain itself needed to move, and
the rents went up.
Well, yeah, I tried to word it in a polite way because there's progress, but with progress, not everybody can survive. And after 65 years, I can't let this end. So I'm moving to the west side. I'm kind of squeezing all this product into a tighter space, but I am utilizing every inch of the space.
Now that you've moved everything, and you've been there, like you said, about 3.5 years, did you find anything that you didn't know you had? And what kind of surprises did you, as you moved out of the building, you find?
That's what surprised me. After 3.5 years of digging in the one location, I still hadn't touched everything. So during the move, while we're boxing things up, and we moved 800 boxes of albums, we discovered more things. I found some local music of musicians that hadn't played around in town in 30, 40 years. I found an album, early album by Detroit Bob Seger that had my brother on the back side of the album. So something like that to carry home and show the family and say, you know, look what I found in this classic record shop, has really been exciting. And I get the feeling that it's just never going to end. If I discovered that after 3.5 years of digging, then I'm just going to keep digging. And that's kind of our motto. Come on in and dig for it. If it wasn't for Record Store Day, I would have dragged out this move for months and possibly a year.
Just but to it, get it a forced, chance to look through everything. Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, and it forced me to say, okay, by this date, I have to have this place shoppable. And, boy, I've been up till 2 a.m. every night doing just that, getting it ready. And I have one more day of full work to do to get it ready, merchandising and kind of sprucing things up, but we'll be ready for sure.
Well, have a good re-grand opening. Hope it's a good day for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's Reverend Charles Preston Smith. He is the caretaker of Dodd's Record Store, where every day is Record Store Day. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
As a part of our Songs from Studio East series, we're exploring music that combines both contemporary and traditional music from around the world. Michigan Radio's Emily Fox has this profile of an Indian fusion band from Ann Arbor.
The group is called Sumkali. Their tagline is Indian music made in America.
When it comes to music, it's one of the few things, I think, that it transcends the language barriers. It transcends many of the barriers that we have as interactive human beings.
That's John Churchville. He founded the band and plays percussion for Sumkali.
And so once you get down to it and start actually making the music, then a lot of the questions about how are we going to do this and what do we do get answered in the music. So it's really a beautiful thing. It's the best part of doing this.
Churchville says half of the members of Sumkali have family ties to India, but everyone in the group now calls Michigan home. And you can hear the influence of both Indian music and, say, Detroit's funk, soul, and Motown roots in a song like Takadi.
Well, this song came about after I'd studied tabla.
An Indian hand drum similar to bongos.
For 3 years with one of the great Indian tabla players in the world, Pandit Swapan Chowdhury, out in California at California Institute of the Arts. And just learned probably 150 compositions, you know, Indian classical bass stuff. And so much of it sounded so incredible. So what we're hearing here, I took one of those compositions that's meant to be played very fast, and I slowed it down to what I call the funk speed. And then and then we actually took the composition off of the drums, which it's intended for, and put it into the melody instruments. So it's taking the rhythm, the classical rhythm. It's from a very old classical rhythmic piece, and we put that to a blues scale on the guitar, and that's where it was born. So it's one of my favorite fusions that we've done.
And you kind of hear this Motown influence within the horns.
Yeah, and I mean, that all just came about because we're sitting in the studio trying to think of stuff that comes, and that's your influence coming in. You know, we're all from down here. We're all very influenced by the Motown stuff and all of the stuff happening in Detroit. And so, yeah, it's inevitable. It's going to creep its way in.
A lot of classical Indian music is built on improvisation. And Churchville says this group of Indian and non-Indian players improvise based on the music they're familiar with. It doesn't have to be based on the Indian tonal structure.
In my experience, when, say, we have somebody new that comes to the group and they play, you can tell, oh, they're improvising using their training from Indian classical music, or they're improvising using their training from jazz or blues or folk. Depending on where they come from, you can hear that influence in the improvisation. You know, in our group, we don't really try to fake it. So the sax player doesn't come in and try to do a rag. He might come in and play jazz changes over some Indian melody. And, you know, if it works, it works, and it's great. If not, then we go back to the drawing board.
But it's not like everyone has to completely learn this new tonal structure that they may not have been growing up with.
Right. But everyone does have to learn how to unlearn all of that.
Yeah,
it's
okay.
Very Yoda-like. You have to, you can't pay attention too much to all of that, because at any one given time, not 100% of the group is totally familiar with everybody else's background and training. So everybody can't move. We have to kind of build our own ship to fly in, you know.
Churchville says when you get down to it, Sunkali's fusion sound is really just classical Indian music accented with Western instruments and sounds.
Yeah, if you actually took our tracks, like take a track where Bidisha sings, you can take out all of the Western instruments, the electric guitar, the saxophone, and just leave the tabla and the voice, and you'll hear a folk Indian folk tune. And really, it's untouched in its rhythmic capacity and in its vocal capacity. It's kind of in its purest form. And so the other, all the dressing around it is kind of the Western influence.
Bidisha Ghosh grew up in Bombay, also known as Mumbai, India. She now lives in Michigan and sings for Sunkali. While this is a fusion band, she says she's only comfortable singing in languages native to India, partly because she wants to preserve that sound, but also because it's the only way she can actually connect to the music she performs.
When I sing, it's soulful, and I don't think when I sing. It's just like, you know, the melody is coming, and, you know, I just kind of get into a different world and I sing it. It's important for me, or it's easier for me to get into that mode if I'm singing in the language that I've learned the art in. And somehow the English doesn't do that for me, or at least has not done it for me yet. If I have to sing a song in English, I don't think I can think music. Like, I can't relate to it the way I relate to songs sung in my language.
Ghosh has spent many years studying classical Indian vocal music. She says people in India take classical music very seriously. She says you aren't encouraged to perform in front of a large public audience unless you studied classical music for many, many years.
You know, I learned, like, in Bombay for 10 years, and, you know, I would perform, but, you know, it wouldn't be on a big stage or anything like that. It would be, like, in a very small group. You were expected to learn a lot before you went and performed in front of a bigger audience. And somehow that has been imbibed into us from a very young age. So that's how we have kind of grown up learning music, that you perform after you've learned, like, many, many years.
John, by learning the music, do you think you and other members of Sumkali have been able to learn about other parts of Indian culture?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the teacher that I've been studying with for the last 10 years is Pandit Samar Saha. He's from Calcutta. And he comes through on a North American tour every year. And so when I study with him, it's not like I go and have my hour lesson. Last time he was here for 6 days and I sat with him for 19 hours. So he's giving me things to work on for the next year until he comes. And when you're learning the music and you're doing it like they do it in India, so, you know, when I'm learning with him, I'm not learning the tabla to be able to play in a jazz group or to be able to fuse it. I'm learning Indian classical tabla. And so in doing that, I'm also learning how to respect the Guruji, how to respect the music. And there's been compositions he's given me where he says, okay, go home and practice this for 4 hours. Come back and show me tomorrow. And if you have it good enough, then I will show you the rest of the composition. But if not, you may never play it again.
John Churchville and members of Sumkali take their music seriously, but they're also able to easily play in public here in the U.S. Sumkali performs each month at the Crazy Wisdom Tea House in Ann Arbor. They'll be playing there this Saturday evening. As part of Michigan Radio's Songs from Studio East series, you can also see Sumkali perform at Michigan Radio Studios. We've posted the videos to our website at michiganradio.org. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
Songs from Studio East is supported in part by the Michigan Humanities Council, an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. A couple of weeks ago, my stepdaughter was excited to show me an article in the local quarterly magazine, Homefront, in Tecumseh. One of her classmates started her own business, and it was featured in the magazine. Zoe Powers is 14 and not only works at a catering business, but she runs her own cakes and confection business with a memorable name.
Me and my mom, I kept trying to figure out what to call it, so I kept asking her, and she decided to tell me to call it Bite Me, just joking with me, and I decided it was actually a great idea.
Zoe's done a couple of wedding cakes, birthday cakes. Her biggest ever was an 8-layer Alice in Wonderland cake with all the figurines you can imagine. When we visited, she decided she'd show us how she makes a pumpkin pie while we were there. She's got her own recipe. The puppies were not happy about us being in the house and locked up in the other room. You can hear them in the background. The question I really wanted to ask was, how do you become such an enthusiastic baker at age 14? Well, the answer is you start spending time in the kitchen with mom when you're 7.
I just started helping her, and then eventually I told her to get out of the kitchen.
Definitely all hers. She does run the kitchen.
Zoe's mom, Amy, says her daughter has practically lived baking.
And it went from trying it on her own to doing it to making her own recipes. It was just her own passion that drove her.
The 14-year-old entrepreneur says the next step is to start taking classes at Washtenaw Technical Middle College.
You start out with just doing your high school and work, but then a couple college classes get added, and they're the only community college that offers a culinary arts degree. What is it, associate's degree? So that's something that I'd really like to do along with doing business and culinary and confections.
In the meantime, Zoe Powers says she's baking for Bite Me, learning how to airbrush cakes, and looking for inspiration. Thank you. listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found where you live can make a difference in how long you live. It's already been established that the more money you make, the more likely you'll live longer. But this new study finds low-income people who live in affluent cities tend to live longer than people of similar incomes that live in cities such as Detroit. Joining me to talk about this is Peter Hammer. He's a professor of law at Wayne State University and the director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights. First reaction, is this study's result at all surprising to you?
No. I mean, the fact that income actually influences life expectancy is something that we've known for a long time. And the rich get richer, and the rich often live better.
But living in a poorer city versus living in an affluent city?
Yeah. I mean, in essence, what you have to think about is what is the opportunity structure that surrounds an individual. And even poor people in richer cities that have greater opportunity structures are going to be carried somewhat by the wave. There's a saying that says it's much better to be poor in a middle-income neighborhood than it is to be middle-income in a poor neighborhood, because you have to look at the environment and the structure of the built surroundings as well as the individual.
Give me some specific examples. What are the root causes that might lead to this?
Yeah, the study itself says that if you look at median house values, right? So the residential property matters. If you look at government expenditures, that matters. And then you step back and say, well, those two are incredibly related, because the property values determines the property revenue that a city gets, determines the amount of expenditures they have. So even in that context, you sort of think about what a city with wealth can do in terms of the quality of the education, in terms of the quality of the recreational opportunities, in terms of the safety of the environment and the level of stress that people are facing, in terms of the availability of a grocery store, things that most of us take for granted.
And even if the cops are patrolling your neighborhood or not.
Yeah, or how they patrol, right? And the sort of assumptions that they're making about the residents that they're going to be coming into contact with.
Those stress levels about high crime and always being danger, that's something that I think a lot of people don't quite understand how much of a toll that takes on people's lives. You know, in an interview with NPR, one of the authors indicated there are some places where the poor are doing well, gaining just as much in terms of lifespan as the rich. And there are other places where they're actually going in the other direction, where the poor are living shorter lives today than they did in the past. So it's not just a difference we're talking about. It's a difference that's getting worse. Any ideas why it's getting worse?
Yeah, in complex systems, when things start to unravel, they often unravel at increasingly sort of rapid rates. But one sort of caveat to think about the study and keep this in mind, I think this is one of the most major limitations. This is looking at race-adjusted, ethnically-adjusted life expectancy once you reach 40 years old.
Okay, right? Explain that to me. What does that mean?
Yeah, that means that the only thing they're looking at is you don't count unless you've already made your 40th birthday. And then it looks at all the health implications of people from 40 to 75 to 80, however long they're going to live. One of the most important public health questions is, how do you get somebody to live till 40 years old? Issues of infant mortality, maternal mortality, Head Start, education, which come out in the later end, saying that all those things matter to have gotten you 40 and make you live longer, aren't addressed here. And some of the more important sort of pressing public health and public policy concerns are really rooted at, how do you get people living in poor cities to actually make their 40th birthday?
We know between men in the top 1% and men in the bottom 1% of income, there's an average of 15 years. We're not just talking about just 3 years or something like that,
yeah.
You know, to clarify, the rich living longer. But just living in a more affluent area kind of makes a person want to move to a rich suburb. That doesn't seem likely for a lot of folks. Yeah. What do you think can be done to help low-income people living in a poor city survive longer, live better?
One of the things this highlights is that the income matters. And another kind of limitation, this looks at income and not wealth. And if you actually look at wealth disparities are far greater than income disparities in the United States. And then you say, well, is that accidental? Not only are they large, they're growing, right? So you look over time for the last 40 years.
Okay, I'm going to stop you just for a second. Explain the difference between wealth disparity and income disparity. I mean, we're talking about holdings like owning a house and having a savings account versus just the amount of money you make. Is that
absolutely
what we're talking about?
So, okay. I mean, one is what you're going to get on your W-2 form as everybody's filling out their taxes. The other is, what's your wealth accumulation? So if you think about wealth disparities in terms of race, 13 times more in favor of the white family than the African-American family if you look at wealth, whereas their income disparity in any given year is probably going to be a lot less. But the key question is what you asked earlier is first, why is that so and what can we do about it? This notion of using the tax code to actually reduce income disparities is something that we have not done for over four decades. Basic things of saying progressive income tax, right, is not a dirty word. That people who make more, when I grew up, it was viewed as actually an honor or an attribute to be able to say you can give back more. The earned income tax credit at both the federal and the state level are huge things in terms of boosting income at the lowest level. And then the strength of the safety net that exists in terms of those that aren't making the level of income are huge supplements in terms of thinking about health and life expectancy.
What do you say to people who say, all right, that sounds fine, but, you know, already the people making more than $250,000 a year are contributing about 51% of the income tax to the government nationwide. We've paid more than our share.
Well, I mean, you just go back to the statistics that are reflected here. What you're basically saying is you may think you have paid more than your share, but you're consigning huge percentages of the American population to living 15 years less.
Or you get to live 15 years longer.
Yeah, you know, and I think sort of realizing these are really life or death questions, right? It's a matter of statistics, but income matters, and that's going to be translated into how long people are going to be living and how healthy they will be.
There's one other thing. If you look at the map that was published with the study, you can see not only is Detroit among the problem areas, but the range of low life expectancy stretches north into the Thumb area and even as far west as over to Lansing. What do you make of that? Because it's not just urban areas. It's rural areas, too.
Yeah. First, these are breaking down into smaller units than past studies, but they're still not breaking down into small enough units is sort of one caution. So most of the units are capturing about 500,000 term life population bands. So even within that, you're going to have substantial disparity. But your point is well taken. That is not only the sort of city limits of Detroit that are experiencing lower life expectancies and gradients of income. And I would attribute part of that going back to state policies. And it's hard, exactly what I have to say, this is not sort of the policies in the last 6 months or the last even 6 years that are going to create the structural differences. But we've had very substantial reductions in state revenue sharing. Right, and the state revenue sharing reduces the amount of social services. And one of the other findings of this report is the amount of local government spending on social services contributes to life expectancy. So some of those things are going to be playing out. Other things are saying that there is a linkage here in terms of just the Rust Belt, a trend that goes beyond just Southeast Michigan or even Michigan as a state, is linking in the effects long-term of deindustrialization and the erosion of the tax base and the implications that that has on multiple dimensions of individual health and the health of a municipality and the health of an entire region.
Sounds like everything starts in Lansing and Washington.
Yeah, well, those matter tremendously. But at each level, somebody can be doing something better to improve health. And one of the findings here is that health behavior matters. And I would never put individual health behavior to the exclusion of structure, but it's a wake-up call to say there's a movement internationally and nationally about health in all policies. Every time a decision is made by a public actor, whether it's the zoning board, whether it's the state legislature, whether it's the county executive, should be considering the implications of that decision on health and thinking structurally over the intermediate and long-term how each one of these decisions actually contributes to the social and economic determinants of health. And in the long-term, we can all be making better decisions in terms of improving the population health and our individual health.
Peter Hammer is director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State University. Thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A combat soldier understands fighting for your country. However, it's tougher when you're forced into a fight with your government. That's where Anthony Gazvoda has been finding himself lately. The former Army sergeant joins us now on the phone, along with his attorney, Jason Turkish, who's in the studio with me. So, Sergeant, let's take this chronologically. You served in Afghanistan. What was your job there?
Job there was route clearance.
Which entails what?
Going out before maneuver elements or support elements and clearing the road for IEDs or possible ambushes, just any obstacles that could be in the route.
So the enemy knows you're coming, probably, because they know where they planted the IEDs. So I imagine you've run into a few firefights that way.
Yeah, definitely.
How many?
About 34 firefights, and then we had over 32 IED incidents.
Mm. After leaving the service with an honorable discharge and commendation for valor, you got a job as a border control agent with the Department of Homeland Security, but you had some problems. Tell me what happened.
I moved to Laredo, Texas in 2011 after I graduated the Border Patrol Academy. And after 2 months of being down there, my sleep started to be off a little bit, and it just progressively got worse and worse, almost to the point where I didn't even realize what was going on. And then after maybe about 10 months of being down there, my supervisor actually approached me at the checkpoint and kind of indicated I didn't look the healthiest. And that's when I looked at myself internally and went and sought aid at the VA down in Laredo. And nothing turned up when I sought aid at the VA there. And then I ended up returning to Michigan on unpaid leave status to seek help back in Michigan.
What did the doctors determine?
The doctors determined I was suffering from PTSD. I was experiencing anxiety, insomnia, depression when I was down in Laredo. And they determined it was the environment in Laredo, the climate, just the geographical location in a largely densely populated area that I wasn't familiar with. And they determined that I needed to be removed from that environment.
What was it about Laredo that was giving you problems that Michigan doesn't?
I think it was just all the aspects that triggered my PTSD. It reminded me of Afghanistan in a nutshell. I mean, the climate was similar, the terrain was similar, the operations for Homeland Security were similar that I was doing.
I've been looking through the court documents here a little bit, and the government's making the case that the only part of Laredo the plaintiff enjoyed was his job, and then they suggest things like the only environmental trigger he consistently refers to that is unique to Laredo is the fact that there's a large Hispanic population there and that they speak a foreign language. Then they say, again, the government says, the plaintiff's accommodation request is a request to be moved out of a predominantly Hispanic environment to a more Caucasian environment. I mean, it kind of says you don't like brown people.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. That whole argument is ridiculous. First of all, that's a comment of the doctors. That was never my thought process when I was living down there or anything. I did enjoy the job in Laredo. I loved the job in Laredo. That was the only thing that literally kept me sane down there for 10 months was actually the work. My spare time down there was pretty much just holed up in my apartment because I just couldn't shut off the hypervigilance.
Jason Turkish, I'll ask you as the attorney. The government is fighting Mr. Gazvoda's request to be transferred to his home state, Michigan, to patrol the border there. What's going on with this?
Where we're at, Lester, is we've exchanged a fair amount of briefing in this case, and we had a hearing before a federal judge back in February who this week has now issued a ruling that in fact affirms what we've said all along, which is that Sergeant Gazvoda's doctors themselves, who, by the way, are employed by the federal government, that they're the ones who determined that Laredo is not a suitable placement. But they've also determined that he is still capable of doing the full duties of a Border Patrol agent. And the federal court has agreed that this is the simplest of simple reasonable accommodations to simply follow the advice of the government's own doctors, take him out of the environment that reminds him of Afghanistan, where he was repeatedly shot at, and to acquiesce and just allow him to continue to serve his country up on the northern border. Here's why I'm particularly proud to represent Sergeant Gazvoda. Nobody would blame him if he said, I just can't do anything. You know, it's been too hard. It's been too difficult. I'm just going to go home and stay on disability benefits. And no one would blame him. He served his country in ways that we can't even imagine. But instead, he says, I want to go back to work. And I respect that immensely. And I don't understand why the Homeland Security Secretary doesn't too.
Now, he's sued the federal government. That's why this is in court. But he's not asking for money.
Not a penny.
Why?
Well, because, you know, you really have two options in a case like this. You can sue for what's known as equitable relief, which is an injunction, or you could sue for money damages if, in fact, this ended his career and he wasn't able to work. Sergeant Gazvoda isn't interested in ending his career. He's interested in continuing his career with the federal government. So, you know, he has not asked for a penny of damages. Never once has it been suggested that he wants to seek monetary damages in this case. The only thing he's suggested is that he wants to be in a location that his doctors agree would be more appropriate. And, you know, he's a very humble individual, but he's not exactly asking for a reassignment to Pebble Beach here. I mean, Port Huron is in the winter on a snowmobile patrolling the border. is still very difficult work, and he doesn't shrink from that responsibility at all. He wants to do the difficult work of protecting the borders. He just wants to do it in a way that's safe for everybody.
A federal judge, as you mentioned, has granted a temporary injunction in this case. So what's the next hurdle? Why can't he just go ahead and get that job?
Well, candidly, the government's going to decide at this point how many hurdles they want to put up. The Homeland Security Department could simply take notice of this ruling and transfer him today. The government does have the ability to continue to fight us and make us go through the somewhat pro forma process of going into discovery and finding that a specific single position exists. Now, it's hard to fathom that a federal agency the size of Customs and Border Patrol, in the year that this request was pending, more than a year, that there was no movement and no positions available. So we hope that discovery will not be all that difficult and that we'll find him a suitable position. Unfortunately, it's somewhat up to the government at this point.
Why would the government fight that? I mean, what's the point? What's the larger point about fighting a transfer for a guy who's got a good record, except that he got sick and this PTSD was inflamed by where he was?
Well, that's just it, Lester. There's no point. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson should look at this veteran and say, we need to accommodate him. We need more people like him who want to serve our country. Protecting the homeland includes, in my opinion, standing up for the people who protect our homeland, both here and abroad, like Sergeant Gasvoda. So I don't particularly, from where I sit, see any reason why the government has done this other than to frustrate what should be a relatively simple and painless transfer.
Mr. Gasvoda, what do you think about this resistance to get this transfer to patrol the Canadian border instead of the Mexico border?
That's a good question. it's been a hard road, and I just hope it gets resolved.
You fought for your country, and now you're having to fight the federal government over this. Do you feel a little betrayed?
It's easy to say that you would feel betrayed, but I mean, all the people in Homeland Security, they have a job to protect the borders, and I just wish they would take a little time to look into this case a little deeper and come to a reasonable decision on it.
I want to thank you both for coming in and talking with us. Just a note, we asked U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid or a spokesperson to join us. The federal government told us it does not comment on pending litigation. The U.S. Attorney's office did share some court documents with us. We also reached out to the Department of Homeland Security. They did not respond. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Lester.
Thank you.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstrath. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Josh Hakala, Sean McHenry, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.